necessary to be a leader in the complicated healthcare world. Details at uwp.edu.
Welcome to Generation Now. I'm your host, Troy McDonald. I'm pleased to welcome Nilay Patel, co-founder and now editor-in-chief at The Verge, one of the largest technology and culture websites in the world. Thanks, Nilay. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about your roots. You're a Racine area native. What was it like growing up here?
I am a Racine native. My family moved there when I was like 2 or 3 years old. I grew up technically in Mount Pleasant, but when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s in Racine, everyone just called everything Racine. So the idea that Mount Pleasant is a real thing now and Foxconn is there is very, very strange to me. But I grew up in Racine. I went to Racine Unified Public Schools. I went to Prairie for high school. And, you know, the thing is, I always think when you leave a place and you've been away for a long time, you're more from that place than ever. So I've been in New York for almost 10 years now, and I feel more like I'm from Wisconsin and from Racine than ever before, and I feel very close to it.
And I think the last time I heard on the Vergecast that you were here over the holidays, I believe.
Yeah, my parents are still there. The house I grew up is still standing. I didn't manage to burn it down when I was a teenager. We come back several times a year and ramble around Racine and go to Regency Mall, and I still go to the same Best Buy I went to when I was in high school. It's very much home.
Wow, that's so funny, because I've been to that Best Buy so many times, the Olive Garden and the Regency Mall complex. Yep. Delicious. So there's this whole conversation going on here about bringing millennials, bringing young people here, and you're an example of someone who got educated here in our area and then left. So kind of talk about your transition from being from Racine, this area, and then going to New York.
Yeah, you know, I would have bet you that I ended up in Chicago, not New York, which is still a problem, but I would have landed a little bit more closer home if you'd asked me. So, you know, I went to obviously school in Racine. I went to undergrad at the University of Chicago. I actually came back to Wisconsin. I went to law school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And then I moved to Chicago, which is kind of where I saw myself being for my life, and to be a lawyer. And literally one thing led to another. I started blogging about technology for a website called Engadget. I made $14 a post. This was during the heady early days of the web, I guess. And that led very quickly to me becoming the managing editor of Engadget, moving to New York. And then 12 of us actually left Engadget, which was owned by AOL at that time, and we founded The Verge, and as part of the company that is now known as Vox Media, which owns Vox.com and Eater and SB Nation and Curbed and a bunch of other sites that people love. So now we're a much bigger company. So it to me, it feels like a tumble of opportunity that was created by the internet, and I would have never guessed that I would have ended up living in New York and being a tech journalist. But to me, what's really important is technology touches everyone. It's part of everyone's life. And huge companies like Apple and Google, they're not like as rarefied as you think. They're not out there. They're just a bunch of people. They happen to like live in California or whatever. But they have really similar problems as every other business. They have really similar ideas. They have this enormous impact on our lives. But if you actually get to talking to people who work there and doing the reporting, you find out that they're trying to solve the same problems as everybody else. And that to me, that connection between what people think of as like the big problems, the big companies, the most interesting stuff, and what happens in places like Racine, Wisconsin, are not actually very different. And I really hope that we can bridge that gap. That's sort of the promise of technology, is that we'll bridge that gap. And I think we have to push harder to make that promise reality.
You know, that's interesting that you say that, because I think a lot of people, especially here in this area, I mean, the interaction that they have with these companies is at Best Buy. I mean, to kind of bring it to your point. So it seems like such a far away, distant thing. But like you said, these are companies that are filled with people. They're just people.
Yeah. And a lot of those people are from the Midwest. You know, it's not uncommon that I meet Packer fans out in the world, even here in New York. So, you know, to me, you said this is like the big problem is people are leaving the Midwest. I think what you're going to see is people are going to get older. They're going to realize that living in some of the most expensive cities in the world, in New York and San Francisco, is maybe not so appealing when you are no longer like in the early part of your career and you want to settle down, and that there's actually a lot of opportunity that technology has created in other parts of the country. And I think that opportunity is real. Like, it is very meaningful to people. We just have to make sure that we focus it on sort of the correct places, and that we build the sorts of companies that are sustainable, and that that opportunity is sort of democratically spread out and able to be harnessed by lots of people, as opposed to concentrated in large companies. And I think that's a big project. Certainly I'm not going to do it by myself, but it's one that I think if everyone is just aware of and thinking about, it will naturally occur.
Speaking of equitable companies and companies that, you know, spread their business models to help people equally, Foxconn, that story just blew up in this region last week. A Reuters report came out saying that Foxconn was not going to build some of the small LCD manufacturing that they had originally planned. They came out and then they kind of didn't deny it, but they said, you know, plans change, we're trying to be economical. And then President Trump got involved. I mean, it's just, you know, a big mess. So kind of walk us through where we are right now.
Just today, the cover of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine is "Did Foxconn Con Wisconsin?" So the story is, it's really big. The very short version, I think everyone in Wisconsin is sort of aware of the shape of it, is Foxconn was working with the Trump administration on creating a factory space here. The Trump administration went looking for places that they could locate such a thing. The state of Wisconsin was involved. The Walker administration was deeply involved. The town of Mount Pleasant put in this RFP. They signed this one-page contract, which said Foxconn would get some billions of dollars of subsidies, depending on who you ask. It's between like 2 and change to 4.5. And they would get some billions of dollars of subsidies to create 13,000 jobs to build 75-inch TVs, LCD TVs, in what's called a Generation 10.5 LCD plant. And just over time, that has been whittled down. So first it was a smaller LCD plant, what's called the Generation 6 plant. And then I think last week, maybe we won't have a factory at all. We're going to build knowledge centers around the state. To this week, hey, Trump called us. We're going to actually build a factory. And then finally now, I think the big Bloomberg story that came out, no one involved. I think Bloomberg interviewed something like 50 people. No one thinks they're going to generate 13,000 jobs. And so that story, to me, it's very personal, right? That site is just 10 minutes away from my house in Wisconsin. It's 10 minutes away from where my parents were. It's funny for me to be in New York and be a tech journalist and do all this stuff and then have my mom say, hey, traffic on 94 is really bad because of this Foxconn plant. And you just kind of poke at it. And if you're in tech journalism, you very quickly realize that nothing they say is pinned down or attached to reality. And that goes as far as we're going to build big LCD panels in the middle of Wisconsin. That's great. I think we should build things in America. I think I would love to see more manufacturing in Wisconsin. But LCD panels are a very particular type of technology. They require enormous ancillary facilities. They require a ton of water to produce. It was just never made clear like how or why that would happen. It was never particularly made clear what they would be used for, right? Foxconn owns one brand of TVs. They make Sharp TVs. Sharp TVs are not like the best-selling TVs in the country. So if you're going to build all these Sharp TVs in Wisconsin, you need to have some demand for that. Or you need to go to a company like Vizio, which actually is one of the most popular TV brands in the world, and say, we're going to make your TVs for you, which is traditionally what Foxconn does. But like Vizio, according to Bloomberg, said they didn't want that deal. And then you look at where TVs are actually made. They're made in Mexico. They're made in China, obviously. They're made in Japan. Like, there are places where this infrastructure does exist at a much cheaper rate. And so just that first promise, I don't think anyone ever did any due diligence on. Does this even make sense? Is this even cost effective? And then all the sort of subsequent promises, well, that's where, you know, a site like the one I run, The Verge, it's very easy for us to push on hey, you're saying you're going to build an AI 8K plus 5G ecosystem. That's just like a lot of letters, and they sound great, but like I'm in that world. Reporters of The Verge know the best AI researchers in the field. We cover 5G network deployment every day. We're deeply, like, I was just at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. I saw the world's first 8K TVs. What does this mean? Like, what are you actually building? And it does not appear that they have good answers to the question of what does this actually mean? And I think that fundamentally is the problem. I think the people of Wisconsin should be asking that question. It's not hard to like get this information or ask the right questions. And then I think, national publications like The Verge and Bloomberg are going to keep pushing on, hey, if you want to build 5G, like, tell us how you're going to work with AT&T and Verizon, who are racing to deploy those networks right now. Like, what does this really mean?
Right. Except we don't want the fake icons, 5GE or whatever it's called.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's right. There's a race to say you're the first to 5G. And AT&T and Verizon are doing all kinds of shady stuff to win that race, like putting fake icons on the phone. Well, how is Foxconn going to participate in that? Like, that's a really easy question to ask. And you don't need to know a lot. You don't need to be an engineer to ask that question. You just need to look at the industry and say, well, here's the shape of these words that you're saying. Here's the reporting on people doing stuff, spending money, making products, selling products. Any consumer tech website, not just The Verge, will like show you that stuff. And then you should ask Foxconn, like, how do you intend to participate in this? How do you intend for the billions of dollars in tax subsidies that you're collecting to turn into products that you then sell that is part of this thing that you're claiming? And I don't know that a lot of that work has been done, and I definitely know that Foxconn has not been forthcoming with those answers.
And, I want to touch on this and translate this kind of to Amazon's HQ2. There was a report that came out this week that there was a gentleman who was appointed who's not really a fan of the project, and now that project in New York is kind of curtailed. There has been an outpouring, an outrage over Amazon's HQ2, which is a fraction of the cost and incentive that Wisconsin gave to Foxconn. And so I'm kind of curious why you think there hasn't been an uproar with, I guess, nationally and with Wisconsin citizens, the people right here at the Foxconn deal.
I'm from Wisconsin. I live in New York. I feel like I have a pretty reasonable perspective on this, but I'm sure some people will disagree with me. New York is a vibrant city full of people who are very proud of New York. Queens, where HQ2 is going to be located, is a neighborhood. It exists. There's lots of people who live there. There are great restaurants there. There's already commerce. So for the city and the state to give Amazon this tax incentive package to come in and say, we're going to fix Queens, we're going to improve it, you feel that uproar just immediately build. Like, hey, we're already here. There's millions of us here. This is our neighborhood. Like, involve us. Like, give us the money and we'll do it. And if Amazon wants to come in, they can come in because they want to be here and they can pay their taxes like everybody else. So that's like one part of it. I think with Wisconsin, a difference in tone, although I've definitely heard the same sort of criticisms, is, well, they're going to buy a big chunk of land in Mount Pleasant, and most of it doesn't have anything on it. And then, depending on who you ask, they've either paid way over market for some homeowners' land, or they've basically declared a blight and kicked them out. But you've got this sense that there's not this vibrant thing happening in southeastern Wisconsin. And so a lot of people are excited that all this money is going to flood in. And I think the Walker administration was excited that they had a huge, sparkling piece of economic development occurring. And a lot of people in the area, my friend's parents are on my Facebook page saying, come back and visit. You'll see how excited everyone is. They support the deal. I think that's meaningful to people in a way that a lot of the people in New York City were like, no, this is already the biggest and baddest city in the world. We don't need to give stuff away if you want to be here. You have to be in New York. So if you want to be here, you can just pay like everybody else. Whereas I think that sense of, well, you have to be in Wisconsin isn't necessarily underpinning the Foxconn deal. That said, I think the state clearly gave away too much, especially in exchange for promises that now seem very illusory and are so hard to pin down.
I think it's almost like the technology equivalent of a timeshare presentation. That's how I kind of explain it to some older people. When you go and you sit through the 90-minute presentation and you get told a whole bunch of stuff that you, that you don't want to hear, and it ends up not being necessarily true. It's inconvenient, but you're so happy because you get the two free air, tickets. And so a lot of people get that. But that's interesting that you say that. I want to touch on kind of the LCD and OLED technology. I spoke with someone who I'm not going to name who had no idea that Foxconn did not make OLED, never heard of OLED. And that's kind of where things are moving. So kind of even if, let's say, they did build those 75-inch screens that are LCD, the industry is moving in a totally different way.
Yes and no. There's two ways to think about what drives paradigm change in consumer technology. One is, I think everyone's pretty familiar with it, is like input device changes. So we had keyboards, we added mice, computers started to look radically different. We added touch screens, computers look radically different. Now we're adding voice, computers don't even have screens anymore. There's speakers in your home. So as input methods to computers change, you see these like big paradigm step changes in how we design computers, how they fit into our life. The other one that is just as important that I think gets maybe less credit is screen technology. So we started with cathode ray tubes. You know, the TV in your living room was a giant box. We went to flat panel plasmas. The TV got flat. We mounted it on the wall. We went to LCDs. LCDs are literally everywhere. They're in most of the phones. They're in most of the TVs. They're the screen in your car. They're the screen in the medical equipment. LCDs are the most prevalent display technology in the world. They're hugely important. They're not going anywhere, but they have become largely commoditized. And there's a bunch of stuff they can't do. The next generation of those technologies for right now is OLED, which stands for Organic Light Emitting Diode. And they enable the screens to be thinner. They enable the black levels to be deeper. People claim they're infinite. And they enable them to curve. So an LCD, a liquid crystal display, to literally get light out of the screen, there are LEDs behind it arranged in a grid, and the LEDs light up, and that adds an entire layer of thickness to the device, and it means that they're always lit up, so it's never truly black. An OLED screen, each individual pixel is its own light source. There are millions of microscopic light sources, and when they turn off, they're actually black. So if you have an iPhone 10, you notice the black levels on that are far superior to the iPhone 8's black levels. If you have an Apple Watch, you notice that you can't really see the border of the screen because it's black, because those pixels are just turned off. Whereas if you look at, I don't know, Samsung watch that has an LCD screen, you'll notice you can always see the edge of the screen. So there's clear benefits to OLED screens. Now, they're more expensive. They're harder to make. LG and Samsung are sort of in a battle for who makes the best ones. Foxconn doesn't make these things. They don't make that generation of technology. That's not to say LCD screens are not hugely important. Like, most of the TVs sold are LCD TVs. Most of the screens, again, in your car, in your life, are LCD screens. But it's not a cutting-edge technology that's gonna lead to a step change in how we design computers the way that OLED has led to a step change in how we design things. The Apple Watch really doesn't happen without OLED screens. The iPhone 10 uses the property of OLED screens where they can curve to achieve that thinness and that sort of edge-to-edge display. The Samsung Galaxy line, the screen curves around the sides. You can only really do that with an OLED screen. So there's a thing that people are doing with OLED screens. There's a step change in design that they are enabling. Is there going to be another display technology in the future? There absolutely is. Will that lead to another step change of design? Absolutely it will. So to build LCDs is to make a big bet on the present and not necessarily a big bet on the future. And I think that, again, this is stuff that is not hard to understand. It's not the guys who run DisplayMate are not shy. You can just go to their website and click on it and email them, and they will tell you. And it just doesn't appear any of that work got done before this deal was made.
You're listening to Generation Now on WGTD. I'm Troy McDonald. My guest today is Nilay Patel, who is the editor-in-chief of The Verge, one of the most popular and powerful technology and culture websites in the world. I want to underscore kind of, and this is a big topic here, about kind of the generation gap. On the famous Reply All episode, Dave DeGroot, when asked, why did Foxconn choose Wisconsin? DeGroot, famously, answered, they came to Wisconsin to get in touch with the kids and all of their, technology. I think there's a bigger generation gap than ever before. I mean, you have some kids who are just so adept. They're building websites, they're coding, they're doing all this stuff, and parents who have absolutely no clue. Do we rectify that? And how did that kind of play into Foxconn's appeal to this area?
You know, I live in that generation gap. I love pushing all the buttons. I love talking to people who build stuff. Technology is literally my career, and my parents are not so great with it, right? And I feel that, but the problem here is a bad business deal. It's not some philosophical divide between the old and the young. It's literally a question of, what are you saying you're going to do? If we go ask experts if that is realistic, will the experts tell us it's realistic? And whether those experts happen to work in technology or whether they work in car manufacturing or whether they work in medicine, those experts exist. And they're really just not – I mean, I'm a reporter. You're a reporter. They're not hard to find. I'm talking to you because you just sent me an email. Right? It's like – it's that work is simple to be done. And the risk is you're going to go talk to the experts and they're going to tell you that the thing you're excited about is not worth being excited about. It's not worth pursuing. And I think that is more than anything. The technology industry is good at making promises it maybe can't keep, but keeping the excitement level high. So if Ford was rolling into Wisconsin and saying, we're going to build all the Mustangs here for the rest of time, well, you would say, well, Ford, Mustang sales are going down. Like, what are you going to do when no one wants sedans anymore? Like, Ford has literally stopped producing all cars in America are done, and they're only making trucks and Mustangs. So you would just go talk to the experts. You would just look at the sales charts and say, well, if that line keeps going down, what's your plan for the next thing? And how are you going to support all these jobs? The tech industry is just good at promising like endless innovation. But there are some real questions about whether that's sustainable. Apple phone sales, the iPhone is the most revolutionary product of all time. It's just flat out, right? Like, mobile phones of that caliber have radically changed the world. You know what? It's 10 years later, their sales are beginning to plateau because people have enough phones. Those roller coasters come to an end. Those pendulums swing back. And I think the tech industry is good at saying it can keep pushing forward. And for the large part, it's true. But I think if you're going to give away a lot of taxpayer dollars, you're going to give away a lot of land, you're going to make a lot of promises to an entire generation of people in literally my hometown, we should ask harder questions.
You said that this is not a battle between kind of the old and the young, and it's just really about doing the hard work and just reaching out. Do you think that millennials and Gen Z deserve a seat at the table, though, to help policymakers in those discussions? Or is it really just the leaders who are in power just doing the work?
Oh, I absolutely think the young people should be at these tables. This is our world, right? I mean, it's there's only one planet. And if you're talking about building factories that may pollute, if you're talking about using water from a scarce natural resource like Michigan, you've got to have some generational perspective on this thing. So I think just from the incentive structure of who's going to be around the longest, you should put young people at the table because you're making decisions that are going to extend out into time in a massive way. And then I do think there is some sense of, okay, yeah, maybe young people do use their phones more. Maybe it is more obvious that you should ask questions about the longevity of LCD technology in mobile devices if you use your phone all day and you're aware that you're looking at an OLED screen and an LCD screen. So, like, yes, there's probably some sort of, like, personal experience element to this. But I think there's also very much a good government element to this. And, you know, just sort of watching how our government is going, watching the sort of pendulum shift between how sort of an older generation thinks market forces can handle everything and a younger generation is like, pump the brakes, like, you know, we need some like good public policy here. I think that conflict needs to be healthier. And I think the younger generation, at least as far as I can tell, they're the ones who are saying, you know, these big tech companies, they haven't kept all their promises. They didn't build us a giant sustainable economy. They did offshore all these jobs to China to manufacture all these devices. We need to pull that back. We need to see it at the table. And I think that's where the younger generation in particular needs to get more vocal in deciding what the world they want to live in looks like, making policies now to build that world, and then holding people accountable to their promises. I just really don't think, and I feel this very strongly, that there's some ineffable understanding of technology that only young people can have. It just has never been my experience. You know, one of my mentors is Walt Mossberg. He's 30 years older than me. He has a better sense of technology than almost anybody I've ever met in my life. So it's not that. I think it's much more, are you asking the right questions? Are you pushing towards the right outcomes? And are you saying we have a clear sense of values for the world that we want to live in? And how is technology going to help us build that world, not how are we going to get out of technology's way?
We're wrapping up here on the program, but I wanted to ask you if you could tell the Mount Pleasant officials like Dave DeGroote, you know, and others, you know, one thing, you know, now as they're wading through the waters of, you know, trying to figure this all out, what would you say? What would you ask?
You know, the best technologists I've ever known are they're the fastest to admit that they've failed. Right. There's a saying in sort of Silicon Valley and the tech industry, like, you just want to fail fast. And it's fine if you can admit that you have failed and you can learn something from that failure. Your chances of being successful as an entrepreneur, as a technologist, as an engineer are so much higher. But increase your rate of failure. Right. Just know, like, be willing to call it. Be like, we made a bet. It didn't pay out. You know, one of the most popular apps in the world, they're going to file to go public, is this company called Slack. Slack started out as a video game. It's a team chat system. For my whole company runs on Slack. We chat with each other on Slack all day long. They started out trying to build a video game, and they built themselves a chat system to help them develop this video game. And they quickly realized their video game was going to be a failure, but the chat product was good. So they dropped the video game, made the chat product, and now, you know, they're going to be a $1 billion company that goes public very soon. You got to fail fast. You got to let go of the things you thought you were going to do and move on. That is the story of the tech industry. It is the thing that makes tech entrepreneurs exciting to talk to. It is a thing that makes our companies nimble. It's a thing that makes them successful. It's why they build billion-dollar companies. And I think the city of Mount Pleasant, Dave DeGroote, all these folks, they have a lot to learn from that mentality to say, hey, this might be failing. We need to change. And to just hold on to it because you had this dream or you had a vision or you think, I think he said, Dave DeGroote said to Shruti Pinnamaneni, who's the great reporter from Reply All, we just have to hold on to positivity and it's all going to work out. That's not actually the lesson from the tech industry. The lesson from the tech industry is call it as fast as you can. Call it a failure as fast as you can so you can move on to the next thing. And I think that lesson in this moment would put a lot of objectivity back onto the table and let us kind of rethink that deal.
Fascinating conversation. It's interesting you say that because I saw on The Verge, I check it out every day, Energizer is getting into the phone business. I mean, not that we have to talk about that, but it's just like, are you the battery company? It's like exemplifies what you're saying. Here's this battery company, and they're getting to the cell phone business. So it always changes and evolves. Neelai, you're the greatest. Thank you so much. I'm an admirer of your work. I think what you're doing at The Verge is just incredibly awesome. Thank you for coming home for a few minutes with us. I sincerely appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. Like I said, I'm so proud to be from Wisconsin and happy to be talking to you.
You can follow Neelai on Twitter. He is at Reckless. Visit TheVerge.com and listen to The Vergecast wherever you find your podcasts. We'll see you next time on Generation Now.